Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The coronavirus pandemic understandably has many people feeling a bit anxious. Today, we talk about the fear and anxiety this new virus is causing and share some thoughts on coping. While we're asked to practice social distancing, many people are taking it further and putting themselves and their families in self-quarantine. We invite you to share your thoughts with us this morning. What are you doing and what are some of the ways you're making the best of a difficult situation? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We are also practicing social distancing. Our guests join us on the phone this morning. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
And social worker Ann Gagan, good morning.
Good morning.
So the uncertainty of all this can be very unsettling, to say the least. Mark, why don't you start?
Yeah, that's exactly the trigger. You know, we're dealing with two pandemics at this point. One is the viral pandemic. The second one is the pandemic of fear, pandemic of anxiety. And that they go hand in hand. One feeds the other. The reason that the viral pandemic is so threatening is that it's really uncertain. We don't know much about it. We can't predict it. We haven't had it before. This is a unique virus. It behaves in a unique way. The medical professionals are very limited in knowledge. On the other hand, they do have knowledge, but it is not as much as it needs to be. You can blame all sorts of systems for that, but that's the fact. So you make the best with what you have, that you can't predict what exactly is going to happen. And in that state, being unable to predict or have a reliable sense of being safe in the future is the trigger for anxiety. And it's basically wired into us from millions of years of evolution. That the whole evolution of life is driven by the need to survive. That from, you know, one-celled organisms to multi-celled to plants to animals, it's all driven by the need to survive. Any living thing has that in common. So about a million years ago, the brains started to develop a part of the brain that hadn't been there before. It's called the front part, the prefrontal cortex. And that is our thinking part of the brain. That's our part of the brain that we use to plan with. When there's uncertainty, that part of the brain comes online runs scenarios of what possibilities might happen. So that's good, because that then can guide our behavior in the present. But it also comes with anxiety, you know, stimulates the brain to do that, it also is driven by fear, which comes from the lower parts of our brain, is the like the gasoline for it, and makes the intensity. And the lower parts of our brain are responding really to what's uncertain in the environment. So we're talking about basic mortality here being threatened, and our brains react. The good news is we do have that prefrontal cortex that can guide us. However, when the anxiety rides gets too high, that prefrontal cortex kind of goes offline. That's when anxiety becomes a pathological enemy, really.
Anybody want to add anything to that?
Well, I would say, following up with Mark, that it's the uncertainty. And the uncertainty causes us to think of our brain, or causes us to think of every possible scenario. The what if, and then, oh, what if that happens? We go into overdrive. Mm-hmm. And it's because that part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, likes to plan, likes to implement, likes to problem solve. And without enough or accurate information, and we know because we've been inundated with a lot of so much information, but they're very few clear portraits of what's really happening. We're not there yet. So that brain, part of the brain that likes to plan and know and prepare, it's not able to do its job as well. It's only doing what if, and oh my God, and reacting physiologically to the stress that the uncertainty brings.
Yeah, uncertainty is that's a big challenge to deal with. And when you think of it, life itself is very, very uncertain. But this really highlights it. This puts a spotlight on it. We do have an opportunity to learn something here, really, about how our brains work.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, you wanted to jump in?
That's actually...
Yeah, I guess the one thing I would add is that, fundamental for all of us, whether we're Republicans or Democrats or whatever, is the anxiety that always comes with uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And none of us who are alive have ever encountered anything like this, unless perhaps you were, living in a country with Ebola back a while ago. I mean, certainly the SARS epidemic, the Ebola, even I would put the HIV in a somewhat different category. I just think what strikes me many, many times every day is that I've never been alive when something like this confronted us.
Yeah.
And, of course, the fact that the picture seems to change on the hour, if not the minute or the day, adds to it. And I don't think any of us, really have the skills to cope gracefully or beautifully or appropriately right down the line with any of this.
Sure. No, we can't rely on our past experience and just kind of apply that. We haven't been trained for this.
Yeah. And you kind of touched on this, and part of the problem is not only too much information, but conflicting information. And what we're hearing, take the school closings, for example. Across the country, we have everything from a few weeks to the entire academic year. So it has you questioning, did we make the right decision? Who's right? And it kind of, pits opinion against opinion here. Well, they're doing it this way. And it would be, I think, maybe helpful if we had some clear direction, right, on what we all should be doing.
Sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. Just for the calming effect of consistency and some linear approach to this instead of the all this input. And again, because we're so incredibly connected, we are picking up information from Wuhan to places in Italy where it's really, really powerfully devastating what they're going through. So we're picking up all this information, let alone in our local community, in our state, and in our region, and in the whole country. And because we're so connected, we're hearing from friends and family. They just told my brothers are in Sonoma County. They've been asked to shelter in place out there.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else. So it's so much information, so much.
Yeah.
And that's probably, I know we're going to get to some
ways
to remediate this, but that's one of the things that we have to be so cautious about.
So we have this anxiety that's as contagious, if maybe not more so, than the virus itself. And Mark, you note that humans tend to exaggerate the danger of unfamiliar threats compared to ones we already know.
Exactly. And that's a feature of evolution as well, because just play the odds. If think of some caveman or somebody walking in the woods and they hear a crack of a stick, well, that could be a predator. Or it just could be a weak stick. Mm-hmm. It could be any number of things. But the individual who reacted as if it were a predator and ran right at the moment of experiencing the sound of that thing, he would survive. More people like that will survive than others who kind of contemplate the meaning of sound. that's a basic hardwire into our evolution that we are the survivors. We're constructed based on what works, and it has worked for eons to overemphasize the negative possibilities, and sometimes underemphasize the positives, possibilities or the things that can kind of counteract it. And everybody kind of is, you can think of it as a dial. And on one end, there's people that can tolerate risk very well and even seek it out. And there's on the other end of the dial are those that avoid it at all costs. And that is partly set. You know, your dial is partly set on a genetic basis, a genetic predisposition at least. But it is modifiable. The important thing is where you are in that dial is going to determine how you experience this particular threat. You want to be aware of how your brain is taking in information and what it's doing with it, and observe it like you would if you can get yourself into the mind frame of being in a movie theater, and what you're watching on the screen is your thoughts being played out on the screen. And just look at the story, observe it, recognize it. That, by doing that, what you're doing is you're exercising the prefrontal cortex and preventing it from going offline. Because if the anxiety builds up too much, then it does go offline, and then all sorts of irrational behaviors can result. One of which is hoarding toilet paper. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might be that toilet paper will be our new currency.
Yeah, you know, and we're going to get to the panic buying in a second, but getting back to that information overload. So we have this new virus that we have plenty of questions about, and staying connected to coronavirus information, some of which may be fact-based and some of which is not, probably not healthy. Everybody wants to know. We've got all these questions, and so we're online, we're watching all this different news, and we're getting this conflicting information, and that adds to the confusion. So how much should we be connected with news and what's happening, and how much should we kind of just like, let's find some distractions?
You want to balance, basically.
I was thinking of the, again, I hate to sound like an oldster, but the good old days where you got your morning paper and your afternoon paper, and you can start your morning with updated information and from reliable sources, from trusted sources, and then go about your day, and then, you know, in the evening, to see how the day went. It seemed to work back then. There, you got enough information, and you weren't driven by accumulating information, because it's kind of, again, it's this weird way of trying to control. If I have more information, I'll know what to do, or I'll. But it doesn't work that way. It just increases the anxiety, because none of it's conclusive.
That's right, it's information overload, and that in and of itself is anxiety provoking and discomforting. Yeah. So we want to be able to observe how driven we are to get certainty when there isn't any available or isn't much available. If you watch the cable news, it's awful much. The majority of it is hash and rehash.
Right.
Just repetition is not going to provide any new information for you. It's just going to stimulate the fears and make anxiety worse. So one of the recommendations I've heard is, you know, pay attention for a half hour a day. Do it once in the morning, once in the evening, once in the afternoon, something like that. And that's it.
Maybe not before you go to bed.
Yeah, maybe not.
Right.
Right. Right.
Well, you know, Mark had passed along some time ago, I guess a few days ago, a piece that spoke to the fact that psychologically, the more times that we are exposed to the same news or information, the more anxious we become, that there's a kind of cumulative effect, as if somehow hearing the same thing four times in a row or within the same day actually increases the sense of urgency, which is illogical on the face of it, but that's how our brains work. I'm not sure why anybody would watch. Well, I haven't watched the news since the last presidential election, but
that's as bad as it gets. And what we're seeing now, it can be worse.
but we have. At least as a country, I don't know if it's true so much in other places. I know it's true in Canada for sure, but you know, we have this obsession with the news. People don't feel right if they go to bed without watching the 6 p.m. or the 11 p.m. news. So I've never really understood that. I think we all have to remember that the people who are employed in the news business, it is their job to keep us engaged and entertained to some degree. Mm-hmm. And so there is a bias toward keeping us watching and listening. And that's not always to our benefit.
Yeah. That's right.
And I think it depends where you get your news as well. I mean, you know, Mark, you mentioned the cable stations, and they're very focused, and they have to fill that time, so they are repeating over and over. And, you know, I think TV news is a little different than, you know, reading in the newspaper versus, and again, depending on what type of radio you listen to. We've been very conscious here not to scare people, to try to offer helpful information and resources, because we understand this is a really scary time. And so the best information is to try to help people understand to what extent we can, what's happening, and what kind of control and what you can do about it, right?
And I certainly was not referring to NPR. I apologize for that all people in the news business are the same. I didn't mean to suggest that.
That's okay.
So, you know, I was just thinking, Mindy, one other little point that we are used to in this news cycle to have our aha moments. I knew it.
Right.
Yeah, and we're not getting any of that. From this, we're not getting any of that feedback of "I was right all along." Look at what he said. Look at what she said. We don't have any of that satisfaction, and that is disturbing to many of us too. That we just are hearing more stuff, and we don't know what to do with it.
Right. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about the fear and anxiety that the coronavirus is creating. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. On the phone with us is psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. I want to turn to panic buying for a minute, because this has really been puzzling, I think, to a lot of folks. We understand, you know, there's a storm, everybody goes for the bread and the milk, and even, you know, this pandemic, I understand, you know, the bleach wipes and the hand sanitizer and that, but why toilet paper?
that's very
you can't find it anywhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the scenarios that our brain might project into the future and would be likely to project is how are we going to meet our basic needs? Certainly food is obviously very important. But then imagine if we didn't have toilet paper in our civilization. That's a basic need, you know, to keep things clean. It's never happened that there's ever been a shortage, I don't think, of something. But it's as if that basic need has become prominent and front and center so that people realize, well, this is something we can run out of. Mm-hmm. And I better get some so we don't run out.
I don't know where it started, though. I think it started in China. They ran out. And you get that information, mm-hmm. and then people are just... you know, that could happen to us too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And panic buying, which is that social contagion, which is sort of an irrational emotional response to, we're going to run out, therefore I must get and hoard and everybody else is doing the same thing. It's very irrational, actually.
You know, I wondered about that, because I thought, did all of a sudden people start noticing, hey, a lot of toilet paper is going to be, I better get some before it's all gone. I wonder, you know, where did this all kind of start? And what prompts what particular item is the thing everybody wants to hoard? I remember a couple of years ago in one of the snowstorms, I went into Stop and Shop, and the entire pepper section was gone. And I was like, why peppers? It was peppers and bananas, right? Why are all the peppers and bananas gone? So, you know, you wonder how these things get started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the good thing is that the trucks are arriving every day. So, you know, as you said, there's not a shortage. The shelves are being restocked. And I love the idea that, you know, Stop and Shop is now opening, I think beginning tomorrow, the stores at from 6 a.m. to 7:30 for people over 60 who can kind of go in and, you know, get what they need before, you know, the shelves get depleted of
yeah,
merchandise.
That's sensible.
Yeah.
Well, it's a creative, I mean, there are a lot of amazingly creative solutions to if we break down the problems. And that's that prefrontal, again, that part of our brain that's like, let's take on a very specific problem and look at how we can address this. And that was very creative. And it's happening all around the country. Mm-hmm. One good idea is being broadcast in other places or picking up. And that's one of the positive things about this is that that part of the brain that calms us and makes us feel reassured and helps us to plan and find solutions. Once we can get some of the panic down, there are some amazingly creative solutions to all the aspects of this mm-hmm. situation.
It really does illustrate that when we're faced with a threat, we need to basically watch how we're reacting and do what we can at the moment that makes sense to diminish some aspect of the threat. That's where our minds need to go. It's a problem-solving mode as opposed to a panic-experiencing mode. That's
and
what
I,
we should strive for.
I don't think I was thinking everyone said, well, I don't have time to learn mindfulness. I don't have time to do this. Well, we do now.
Yeah.
We do now. It's a great opportunity to learn new behaviors, to learn new habits, to address our emotional and psychological needs that in many ways in our culture have been put off.
Yeah.
And I think, again, this is where I think that we have an opportunity in crisis. There's always that paradox to slow down and start paying attention to other parts of ourselves other than acquiring goods.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's certainly nice to see people taking walks along the beach, you know, where I drive past the beach and across a bridge every day on my way to work, and I see people walking in it, and I think about all the people who tell me and my patients who say, oh, you know, I wish I had time to go for a walk every day, mm-hmm. if the weather were better, if I weren't so busy, and now I'm actually seeing people take mm-hmm. walks. It's great,
mm-hmm.
particularly with mm-hmm. members of their family and friends.
Yeah, and this, you know, with the schools being out, this can be a little bit overwhelming. We have, you know, people working from home, people who've lost their jobs, which we'll get to in a moment, and then you've got, you know, the kids at home, and this is tough, especially with some of the younger kids. How do you talk to children about this situation? Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's, you know, there's no magic way of doing it other than trying to assure them that we love them very much and that we're going to do whatever we can to protect them. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take some time, but everybody is faced with this. We're all in this together. And so we're going to cooperate together and do what we can. That's why we're staying in more than we used to. That's why you're not going to school like he used to. It's temporary, but this is something we have to do to protect one another. It is a time where we're looking out for ourselves, but also for people next to us, people in our town or village, whatever.
We also, parents have to model the calmness,
mm-hmm.
and this is very important because children not only listen, well, sometimes they listen to our words, but they mainly are looking at how we behave. And this is very important to present a calm demeanor and to, as a parent, to take those few minutes out each day to do that for oneself. Normalcy, it's not normal to be home all this time, but to create a routine for children, for ourselves, a routine is so important, not just on a daily basis. What to expect? What are we going to do in an hour? What does our day look like? There's reassurance in routine, and it's extremely important. as well as listening to children and talking about their feelings and letting them say what it feels like. Maybe have them draw a picture of what it feels like if they're feeling bored or nervous, and know that feelings help them, educate them about feelings also come and go. And if you're really feeling very jumpy, go outside and jump for 15. but I think the most important is how parents need to take responsibility for modeling the calmness, even if they're not feeling it wholly themselves, or even if they're feeling, but to model it and to model reassurance for the children.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a situation that, like the people in London experienced during World War II, you know, with the air raids happening constantly. You never knew where the bombs were going to fall, and it was one day after another, or one night after another. You know, the English put things very succinctly. They just say, keep calm and go on. That was their phrase to one another. So,
It's interesting. Maybe a month or so ago, my grandson came home from school and was saying that one of the little boys in his class said he cannot go back to China because they have something called the coronavirus and it makes you sick and you have to wear a mask. And I was like, whoa, that he could even remember all that. So now as this is happening, I was saying, remember that coronavirus? This is why we're not going to school. But, you know, trying to explain, you know, how, you know, what does it, you know, he says almost five, so it's hard for him to comprehend. But I have found, you know, on Facebook, there's a lot of crap, of course, but there's actually some really helpful information. And I saw this great little video about how to teach young kids about the spread of germs and you know, how they're invisible. They take a bowl of water and they put pepper in it. And then they had the kids stick their fingers in and then look at your hands. The pepper's on your hands and you touch things. And isn't that brilliant? And just like there, I've been really impressed with, you know, for kids of all ages, there's a lot of educational resources that normally charge you money for that are putting things up online for free right now while kids are out of school. For the younger kids, the other day we had the New England Aquarium had a live streaming of their Myrtle the turtle and feeding the turtle and learning about this turtle. Cincinnati Zoo was doing it with their hippos. And so I think some of that stuff is really helpful when we're trying to think, okay, I'm not a teacher. What the heck do I do with you know, the kids at home? And then the other thing that always comes back to is Mr. Rogers. Do you remember Mr. Rogers? So when I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, look for the helpers. You always find people who are helping. So true, right?
Yeah, that's right. So that's how you communicate with kids and be honest with them. I think that's something you don't want to make light of it or say that everybody is too frightened and nothing's going to happen to us. No, we're alert and aware, but we're going to do what we can right now to protect ourselves, that's what we're doing. That's why we're washing our hands and staying away from school and things like that.
Right. We have an email from Catherine. She says, I find that keeping a routine and setting a goal to accomplish each day helps me be sane. I resist the urge to stay in my pajamas all day and be in a vacation mode. This is the time I can clean up emails, reorganize shelves, go through old clothes and decide what to give away, tackle all those old files, give the basement a good going over, and accomplish tasks I always find a reason to put off. I also try hard to resist the constant call of the kitchen, or I will end this quarantine many pounds heavier. Thanks for that. That's true. Yeah. And so, yeah, some of the things that that we can do to cope with all of this, Mark, you had sent some suggestions. That reminded me, one of them was eat healthy, right? You don't want to be a few weeks on junk food, and you're right. You're going to end up a few pounds heavier for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Eat healthy. Exercise.
You don't want to self-medicate either. I mean, this is the tendency again, is the panic mode. Like, oh, I'm really stressed. I'm really, you know, this is really terrible. Well, I'm going to, you know, too much drinking. You know, you don't want to be smoking when this is a respiratory ailment, as smoking anything, overeating. You know, that's really where it falls into self-medication, and that is not going to help your emotional or psychological state of mind. I really think that that's very important. We laugh about it, but it's really important to pay attention to what one is doing to palliate oneself. There's so many good things you can do, but there are a lot of things that are going to make the situation worse.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, I would say, Mark, you sent a thing along that sort of has just some, real quick, I'll just touch on this. Maintain your routines as much as possible. Avoid crowds, but don't isolate yourself. Sleep, because it's good for your immune system. Yep. Eat healthy food. Don't drink too much alcohol or coffee. Exercise, it's calming and may boost immune function. Get news only from reliable sources. And take breaks. Play a game. Watch a movie. Mm-hmm. I saw something that was suggestion was talking about being again home with the kids, that dinner on the living room floor can be a picnic. So be creative, right?
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, you're challenged to do something that everybody can enjoy, the kids can enjoy, and ask them what they want to do. Get input.
And I'm wondering, too, as we're talking about this, how these fears impact people with anxiety disorders.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's a this is a fertile ground for the increase in intensity of anxiety disorders. We can expect that, and it makes sense. So people say with PTSD, say some combat veterans, they're going to be more hyper alert because now there's real threat in the environment, and everybody around them is threatened. So it wouldn't be, it wouldn't be very understandable that their frequency of nightmares might increase, or their flashbacks might increase, just because the environment is on alert. So people can suffer more, although, you know, there is a paradox, too, I've noticed in some things. When people with anxiety disorders or, some kind of psychiatric condition face a real threat, a lot of times they kind of calm down and their thinking is mobilized to something that's goal-directed, that's for the good. Actually, I've seen disasters kind of shake people out of their rigid thinking and actually be a little bit more open to thinking in other different ways. It kind of jolts people out of their head, so to speak.
I'm wondering, Mark, do you think that's because, you know, we do have a tendency as communities to come together in times of crisis.
Right.
So is it gets you out of yourself, and now you're thinking about, oh, how can I help this situation? How can I help my neighbor? Or your mind is busy on other things, so to speak?
I think so. And also other people are more receptive to communicating with you, when there's a common disaster. I remember the snowstorm of 1978 it produced that kind of social environment for a while. Because we're all in this together, and we can assist one another sometimes in real concrete ways. Go if you're going to go grocery shopping, ask your neighbor if they would like some things brought back to them. So, there's all sorts of ways we can start behaving differently, because we can't behave the same way anymore for a while. Our lives aren't consumed by consumption and the usual kind of patterns of interactions and activities. Example comes to mind. It's like being in church, where you can kind of take some time and look at your life not be always reacting and interacting, but just look at what life is all about. It certainly shows you in spades how vulnerable we all are. So if you ever doubted that, and people like teenagers a lot of times or young adults frequently do doubt it. They're kind of the last ones to come on board and stay out of the bars, I guess. Mm-hmm. The fact is, we are all vulnerable, and the good news is that we can connect and help each other. That's critical.
We are talking about go ahead. Go ahead, Ann.
I was just going to say, in terms of anxiety, I think folks that have a history of an anxiety disorder, it's sort of now you know how I feel.
Yeah. Right.
A lot of time people dismiss it. Oh, you know, stop it. You're overthinking. You're over this. You're over that. And to be understood, to have others know what it's like, that inherently helps people feel, well, a little bit, you know, on the same playing field. And that really is a validation.
Yeah. Absolutely. And something you don't have to be ashamed about.
Right.
Because we're all, that's what eats away at us, is our negative judgments on ourselves, mm-hmm. Generation of shame. This kind of cuts through all that, at least temporarily.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the fear and anxiety caused by the coronavirus and some thoughts on coping. We'd love to hear what are the ways that you're making the best of a difficult situation. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. On the phone with us this morning is psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. And Ann is calling from Yarmouthport. Hi, Ann.
Good morning, Mindy, and guests.
Good morning.
My question or my concerns is, with many people being essentially homebound, what effect do your staff or your guests, rather, think will happen with spousal abuse, child abuse, alcohol abuse, because we are essentially not able to get out and do our regular routine? I'd like to hear what your guests have to say about these questions.
And a very good point. Who wants to start?
And I think you're raising a red flag, because a stress like this is likely to make those things worse, because everybody is stressed and say that there's no more money coming into the house. That is certainly a trigger for acting out behavior and violent, aggressive acts in people that are vulnerable to that or have a history of it and an exposure to it. I think it bears, you know, watching and bears awareness. So that would be one of the obviously negative consequences that could kind of explode in our faces.
Anybody else want to chime in?
Well, I think, again, it's exacerbated because all the organizations and agencies that are responsible to respond, not all of them, certainly there are, you know, the first responders and so on, but everything is shut down to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. But I do know that in terms of those of us that have provide counseling and therapy, those we're finding ways to continue to support folks by telephone or through the teleconferencing, and I would hope that anyone listening that is in that situation would find a way to take action to prevent themselves and their children from enduring any kind of abuse, and do what we always do, which is call and get help, and not sit unattended to.
Sure, I'd like to point out too that along those lines, that the Governor Baker has issued statements or policy changes, eliminating all of the red tape about professionals in our field having teleconference with patients. That is basically the same as coming into the office these days. So regulation doesn't prevent that means of communication. It's been removed. That actually makes some more availability for a professional help to be available and easily accessed.
I guess the concerning thing is, you know, the kids out of school, any kids who may be experiencing, you know, neglect or abuse, we don't have those watchdog, the eyes of, you know, the school officials, which is a little bit concerning.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that economic stress for a second. You know, a lot of times we can sort of foresee some of these things coming. I'm thinking of the restaurants and bars. They didn't see this coming, and all of a sudden it's like, whoop, you're out of work. There wasn't any really time to plan for that. It's not like they're being paid while they're out. That adds on to the stress of all this uncertainty with the virus itself.
Absolutely. Well, it makes you feel more helpless.
Yeah.
You know, we see the president or the White House taking steps to at least say that large amounts of money will be made available to help people out. But and I hope that that is true, because certainly this is devastating to the majority. I think, you know, certainly the large majority of people pretty much live week to week, paycheck to paycheck. And it's really not at all clear. There's no question that just the uncertainty, the lack of funds will increase stress within the home. Wouldn't it be great if we had some smart answers?
Yeah. I think on just one of the things that's really impressive to me is how much the community steps up to help, especially with food insecurity. We, you know, we talked yesterday about, you know, the food pantries are doing a great job. And the schools are still, many of the schools districts are offering, you know, meals, drive up. You know, you drive up and they'll give you a meal. Like, you have three kids, they give you the three breakfasts and lunch. You know, on that end of things, it's great. Although we had one of the food pantry folks say, really, cash is king yesterday. She said, you know, I can buy, for that dollar, I can buy four meals. You can maybe get two. So for those who have, this is a good time to think about, you know, the resources that are really being stretched right now for the people who have not.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that we're still in a shock period a little bit about all these, all the circumstances, all the fallout, and the strategies for dealing with the caller's concerns, which are so real, I don't think they've been developed yet, or they are in development. I don't work for a social service agency, but I imagine that you've got all these amazing helping professionals out there saying, what is it we can do? And I imagine that there's a lot of strategic thinking right now in all the agencies that attend to children and family and domestic violence to come up with some plans and strategies to address these needs during these times. We just are still so early into this, and we're still probably in a little sense of shock.
Sure.
And, absolutely.
We're also an incredibly creative and resilient group of people in this country. I imagine and I hope that some strategies will be developed and broadcast.
Mm-hmm. We'll certainly keep our ear out for that.
Yeah. Overlooked is just how resilient we are. So you just want to get reminded that that this society is an amazing thing in terms of resiliency and reactivity to stress, to unexpected, that has worked out over, say, the recent hundreds of years, at least as far as America has existed, as long as America has existed. We've really, if you look at it, we deserve an A, so to speak.
I have another concern that I'm hearing from listeners, and mostly on the islands, but somewhat on the Cape, is summer people returning early, thinking, there aren't that many cases. Maybe we can ride it out there, or they want to get here before they can't get here. And I think part of the concerns, I know we had some, yesterday or the day before Cottage Hospital on Nantucket talking about concerns about what that, that how that might tax the healthcare system there. You know, you you think about what our summer populations are and how limited we are on the Cape and Islands, you know, when it comes to, you know, ventilators and ICU and that, that sort of thing. That's created a little bit of stress. I'm getting some emails from listeners saying, you know, I'm noticing a lot of summer people coming back a lot sooner than they used to. And it got me to thinking, I'm wondering if the people who are returning early, if they have feel more secure here or something. I'm not sure, you know.
I would think so. Yeah. Because it, you know, it's not an urban environment. And it there's a lot of space between people, more so generally than in the, in suburbs or the urban environment. Mm-hmm.
I think also the Cape and Islands are always felt to be healing environments, mm-hmm. in some ways, that because of the access to nature, because of the calm and slow pace, that inherently folks are drawn to that and the away from the more congested parts of the country. And there is just this idea that it's calmer there, it will be better for us. And I think there's some truth to that. You can get outside, you can walk for an hour and not see another person, or you can see people and make a wide berth, mm-hmm. When you're walking. But there is access to nature, and a lot of the things that we know help people to be able to have a good run or get on a bike. I think it's sort of an adaptive response, mm-hmm. to some of the anxiety they're feeling about, you know, being close quarters, et cetera.
We have to
continue to be generous, even though it's scary.
Yeah. Oh, and everything seems scary nowadays, doesn't it? So one of the things I guess that we want to say, breathe, right? Breathe, exercise, and you know, you touched on mindful meditation.
Yeah.
That somebody talk about that. That's really very helpful for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
It really is. Yeah.
It,
go ahead.
It really is. It quiets the runaway mind temporarily, and that's what I'm trying to say with observing your thoughts. That's what mindfulness is. It's just taking time and in a quiet place where you're not distracted by other things, and just focus on your breathing, and watch how your mind is working, and don't resist the urge to sort of get up and fix something that you needed to do before and you forgot, but now you remember. Resist that urge and just let it go. Whatever thoughts come into your mind, let it go. That quiets the whole physiological reaction to stress directly.
And for people who aren't quite sure how to get going, because I find that I have frequent conversations with patients about learning how to meditate, and different people have different styles. Most people find that if they just simply sit down and try to focus on their breathing, well, for some people that works, and for other people it's difficult, but there are so many different ways. There are apps you can download for free on your phone that will help. There are videos on YouTube. There are books, there are a lot of, or you may just simply know somebody who can give you some simple instruction. So whatever works for you. There's no question that meditation is probably the single most powerful, least expensive, most portable way to get calm and stay calm.
All right. Well, with those thoughts, we have to wrap it up there. I'm sorry to say, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan, thanks for being with us this morning, for all the great strategies and ways to cope. We appreciate that. Maybe we'll see you
take care
next month.
Okay. Take care.
Maybe. We'll see. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. Bye-bye.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.